Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
Welcome to Spoiled Fruit. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we are doing sort of an impromptu Q&A. I promised I would do a Q&A a while ago. We did one the other night, a live Q&A. Some of you joined, so thank you guys, those of you who did join. We had some technical difficulties, so we got started a little bit later than I wanted to, and we were only really broadcasting on Facebook. So I apologize for that, snafu. I have hard times with technology sometimes, and so the program that we were using that was supposed to allow us to simulcast on multiple platforms did not work. And so we're working through that. So hopefully in the future that we can stream again and have a do-over. In lieu of that, though, several of you asked or have asked when that video would become available. And so we're still working on that. We wanted to clean it up because we promised some anonymity for those who ask questions. So out of respect for those folks who were kind enough and brave enough to ask questions, definitely want to make sure we respect those people's privacy. So pull the video for now. And in lieu of that, I am putting out this episode answering some of the questions that came through email and DMs, as well as some of the questions that were asked that evening. And so here we go. The first one I want to answer here is what's going on in Duluth right now. So updates on Duluth. And so there's a few things I would note. So I'm in regular contact with quite a few people there. And some of the updates are basically that you may have noticed, those of you who have gone to their website, again, early on, definitely a lot of praise to them for the level of transparency that they've committed to. And I think it's safe to say, based on, you know, some of the information, some of the internal communication that was going on between Vineyard USA and Duluth, that John Cleaver, the interim pastor there, was largely the driving force behind that. So, you know, as I mentioned in one of the last episodes, there were some allegations of abusive power that were brought against John by Rob Morgan on behalf of Vineyard USA. There was an investigator brought in by Duluth, and John recused himself and went on leave of absence to allow that to play out. And the final report, I got to see a little bit of it, cleared John of any of those accusations. Why they haven't, you know, been a little bit more public in terms of releasing that report, I don't know. And why they haven't made more of a public statement to basically clear, you know, to let everybody know that they cleared John's name, I'm not sure about that either. I can only assume that it has to do with the fact that obviously there's a lot of dialogue back and forth between Duluth and Vineyard USA to try to repair relations between the two. As you guys know, Duluth also authored a letter somewhat similar to the one that Ann Arbor sent in, stating that Duluth was also unhappy with the ways in which Vineyard USA handled the scandals and the situation with the Gatlins in Duluth, and had withheld their 3% tithes and asked for reform as well. And as you guys know, Vineyard USA, shall we say, dealt with that swiftly and disassociated Ann Arbor, and have threatened to pull the, or use rather, the nuclear option on Duluth as well. And so you have a sort of a fracture in that church right now. So in Duluth, you've got folks who are, we'll say, very, very loyal to Vineyard and the Vineyard brand, and they want to stay a part of the Vineyard and move past this and get back to, life as it were, prior to the scandals. And then you've got the side who are still advocating heavily for the victims and do not feel like enough has been done. And so right now there's a bit of friction, I would say, at the local level there. And so it's very much a split. So some of the folks I've talked to have voiced some concerns. So there have been some changes on their church council, which definitely can come into play and probably will come into play in the very near future. So there's been some folks who have resigned from the council, and then there's been a couple individuals who have been appointed to the church council. And I have been notified that there have been some concerns raised about both individuals. One of the individuals has written a book on the Vineyard, and so I think it's fairly safe to say that individual is pretty pro-Vineyard and would probably, I would imagine, vote for and push for reconciliation with Vineyard USA. That individual also brought in a guest pastor recently who preached on Vineyard family and that sort of thing. So their concern is that, this individual is going to sort of align themselves with whatever it takes to smooth things over. The other individual, there's also some concern there about that individual's loyalty to the Vineyard as well. In addition to that, there have been some allegations made that this individual also had a relationship with a minor at some point prior to getting married, which obviously the reason that was brought forward is due to the circumstances in Duluth and the fact that that's the very reason why, they are in the headlines today. And so at least from an optics perspective, a lot of the victims are very, disappointed and frustrated, obviously, as you can imagine, that they would allow somebody, with that history to be on the church council. So there's some definite friction there. Becky Eastfold, who has been on staff there, was just named lead pastor. And so, if I had to guess, I would say that John, who is still on leave of absence, so people have been asking where he is. Unfortunately, it just sort of appears like he's getting sort of pushed out. And so I know this has been really tough on the Clewer family, the entire family, and it's taken quite a toll on John. So so keep him in your thoughts. I think I can speculate, in terms of how this is going to play out and what the future holds. But I think after the civil trial is over, I think it's probably best to hear from the victims when they're able to speak, because I think they will be very clear in how they feel about how things have played out there. So that's your update on Duluth. So unfortunately, it sort of looks like, things are headed in a direction where they're going to accept whatever Vineyard USA provides, and that might be that. All right, other updates here. So, let me look at my notes here. Somebody asked for a simple timeline, which I think is fair, in regards to when Vineyard USA first heard about Michael and Brenda's abuse, what they did in response, when they promoted the pastors to regional heads, when they became aware of the assault allegations, and when they removed Michael and Brenda from leadership, and when they gave them severance. So there's a lot there to unpack. I don't have the dates in front of me specifically when the promotions took place, but I can give a pretty clear timeline in regards to when Vineyard USA became aware of certain things. So starting with the first part, We know with absolute certainty that multiple members of the national team, including Phil Stroud, who is Jay Pathak's predecessor, were informed as early as 2014. You know, the indications are that there was some knowledge prior to that. But in terms of, you know, if we're sticking to concrete evidence, we know at least in 2014, the Ryan Bowers letter made its way to multiple members of the national team, bringing awareness to Michael and Brenda and the abuse that was happening there. Ryan's letter is definitely the most solid, you know, as he kept a paper trail. So we can see who was included on it, the responses he received to it, which obviously were not kind. And we also know that the result of Ryan's letter is they essentially did little to nothing with that. In fact, they demeaned Ryan in the process. And so you go back to the episodes and hear Ryan's full interview. He kind of lays that out. So at least 2014, but there's also some indications. If you read, there's three reports that are really, I think, important to understanding the course of events and who knew what and when. There's still a lot out there, I think, that is not recorded, that if you ask certain individuals, there's murmurs that, yeah, a lot of people, you know, in a lot of different areas knew a lot more than what's actually in the reports. But I think there's a fair amount of information in the reports. So highly recommend if you go to Duluth Vineyard, their website, you can read the entire Grace report. And it's got a lot of good information in there in terms of dates and things of that nature. If you also go to Vineyard USA's website, they also have the guidepost investigation that they did specific to Michael and Brenda Gatlin that has some good information in it. The other one I highly recommend, it's a tough read, but I think for anybody who is still out there trying to minimize the events that occurred in Duluth, the criminal complaint has a lot of information in it. And we'll get to that to some degree here in a little bit, but very, very important, has a lot of good information in it, a lot of dates and that sort of thing. So in terms of when they knew, at least about Michael and Brenda, at least 2014, but again, a lot of folks say that there were a lot of murmurs and rumblings long before that. We know Michael was working with the national team in some capacity, you know, for going a ways back. Obviously, he had a lot of power. He ran Multiply Vineyard, was also considered for national director at one point. And we also know, based on Reagan Wagoner's, you know, testimony and the email documents that he has, that Michael Gatlin was at some point on the executive team as well. And so that three-person executive team, he was definitely on it at some point. It looks like between the Phil Stroud and Jay Pathak years when Jay first took over as national director. So we know he was in that position. And again, that both predates and comes after, you know, formal allegations were levied. So we know that as well. You know, again, Brenda was later promoted to super regional leader. Vineyard USA officially became aware of the sexual assault allegations. We know, according to the timeline, in December of 2022. What's concerning about that is mere days later, the initial communication from Rob Morgan on behalf of Vineyard USA is, again, the first time we see the support from Vineyard USA in keeping Michael Gatlin involved to some extent, even though they knew the nature of the allegations. And as opposed to completely removing both of them immediately, to at least, you know, at the very least from a optic standpoint, ensuring that there is no conflict of interest and meddling within the investigation, they not once but multiple times advised that they you know, have some say over even the investigative group that comes in. So and you can read all those emails as well. They're up there on the website, on Duluth's website. A month later, Vineyard USA also advocates for Michael and Brenda, like I said, getting some say over who conducts the investigation of them and Jackson, which is obviously very concerning. Other communications from Rob are equally as concerning in the sense that one email communication to the Board of Trustees, he says, I'm writing to update you about a situation of which you should be aware. Recently, allegations of misconduct have been levied against Jackson Gatlin, Michael and Brenda's son and staff member of the Duluth Vineyard. These allegations are over 10 years old and correlate with Jackson's time as a volunteer student ministry leader. The Duluth Vineyard has deemed it appropriate to conduct an independent investigation. Michael and Brenda have been asked to recuse themselves of decision-making related to the investigation as senior pastor and super regional leader, respectively. I've been engaged with Brenda, Michael, and their board since mid-December and will fill the role of super regional leader in support of the church, area leader, and regional leader. We are also working to identify an appropriate support plan for the Gatlins. And then he finishes it by saying, as you can imagine, as parents and pastors, this is a very challenging time for the Gatlins and would invite you to pray for them, their family, and the church community. So what's very concerning about this email to the Board of Trustees is that it at least sounds, if even if there wasn't intent there, the overall sort of feel of the email is that immediate support for the Gatlins. There's no mention of the victims anywhere in there or support for the victims. There's a lot of concerning aspects to this and distancing themselves from any decision making. So again, as they say, like Duluth Vineyard has deemed it appropriate to conduct it, so sort of passing off your responsibility in all of this. So there's some concerning things there as well. Vineyard USA initially took no actions in terms of Brenda and Michael's employment. And in fact, in January of 2023, they refused Duluth's request that Brenda not be allowed to attend a Duluth leadership meeting. And this is all documented via email as well. Vineyard USA finally places Brenda on a 30-day leave of absence on February 1st, 2023, after victims started to go public online. Duluth effectively terminates her employment on February 20th, 2023. Vineyard USA would pay Duluth, and so Duluth would pay her along with benefits. So the way that her employment kind of worked, functioned as a super regional leader is, even though she wasn't technically an employee of Duluth, she was acting in her capacity as super regional leader. Vineyard USA would pay a lump sum to Duluth, and then Duluth would pay her employment. So Duluth, like if you look at the series of emails, very much is acting quickly and decisively and saying, hey, listen, this is a fireable offense. And are pushing to take action. And Vineyard USA is either sort of dragging their feet or just flat out disagreeing. And so one of the questions in this was, at what point did they, did Vineyard USA suspend or terminate? Well, they kind of suspend at one point, but at no point did they actually terminate Brenda or Michael in their capacities with the national team. Brenda and Michael ultimately end up resigning. So Brenda on February 24th, 2023 resigns her position as super regional leader. February 26th, Vineyard USA requests feedback on a video that they plan to make public about this whole ordeal. But after Duluth provides feedback, they don't make any changes. And so this video goes up. A lot of the victims are extremely concerned about a number of things, in the video. Vineyard USA later removes the video from the website. And around this time, there's also these conversations going back and forth between Vineyard USA and Duluth. And Vineyard USA is actively pushing to pay the Gatlins a severance package. And again, if you look at the dates, this is long after, there's enough knowledge about the situation to know that, a severance package in this scenario would probably not be appropriate, in any other company. But they continue to push for it, despite the fact that Duluth has objections to it. And Duluth makes it very clear in their correspondence that they will not pay the Gatlin severance. Vineyard USA ultimately just says, listen, They state their intentions to pay Brenda 3 months severance and Michael 6 months severance, along with a separation agreement and non-disparagement agreement. And around this time, there's another email from Rob where he summarizes his call with Duluth Council, where Rob says, and again, this is sort of concerning too. And I was just reading over this again the other day. So Rob sort of summarizes his call with the Duluth Special Counsel, where he says the Duluth Vineyard framework is that Duluth Vineyard has chosen a victim-centric framework for decision-making. This framework has provided Duluth Vineyard with a consistent approach to hard decisions. Vineyard USA is concerned that this approach, while understandable, will be untenable in the long run, particularly if Duluth Vineyard expects all other people involved to adopt the same framework. Vineyard USA has shared that at some point, as things become public through these proceedings, this approach will be open to critique, which is sort of head scratching. You're like, well, if you're taking a victim centric approach, which seems to be the logical and Jesus like approach here, why would that be open to critique? You know, so you kind of scratch your head there. So then Rob goes on to sort of differentiate Vineyard USA's framework, where he says they have chosen a truth-centric or Jesus-centric framework for decision-making, whatever that means. This framework has provided Vineyard USA with a consistent approach to hard decisions. Duluth Vineyard has articulated that our approach may not place victims in the right order. No kidding. Duluth Vineyard has critiqued Vineyard USA decisions accordingly and has communicated that perception at various points has been that Vineyard USA has taken the side of the Gatlins. I wonder why we think that, you know, which can be seen as an endorsement of their behavior, past or present. And if you look at the communications back and forth, specifically between John Clewer and some of the other members of the council and Vineyard USA, you know, they pose a lot of, you know, very poignant questions in regards to that sort of optic. And so it is sort of concerning, you know, Vineyard USA's sort of stance there. And again, you know, we'll talk about potential solutions a little bit later on. But again, this sort of calls into question. It's like, you know, this is why an organization that's this large really could stand to benefit from having an HR, you know, consultant or an HR department even, you know, and we can talk a little bit about that in a moment. So yes, so that's sort of the short and simple timeline. But again, the extensive timeline on the website, I think, is very, very helpful. But yes, I think Vineyard USA, you know, the question right now in the civil trial is how much did they know and when did they know it? And there is at least the documented information that's been made publicly available seems to indicate that they knew. There's even in one of the two reports, I cannot remember which off the top of my head, it's either the Grace report or the Guidepost report, that even Jay himself admits to, you know, witnessing some behavior that was concerning and that he even had recommended, you know, some action be taken before he was national director. So that goes back, you know, a decent number of years now. So it's going to be difficult for them to say that they didn't know anything. All right. So let's get into some. I also want to be balanced here because there were some folks who had some concerns, and I do and have addressed anyone who's emailed with any concerns. And so before I get into this one, I do want to preface it by saying, look, you know, I understand it's not lost on me that there are a lot of people who may have listened or been made aware of the podcast who have been a part of the Vineyard for a very long time. And the Vineyard means a great deal to them. Again, I still have friends who are actively involved, some in leadership, some just attendees, you know, who dearly love the Vineyard. And at one point it was a part of my life as well and made some of my best friends, through attending Vineyard. So I understand that listening to a lot of what we covered, was likely not easy and was very difficult to hear. You know, I had a conversation with a gentleman early on where he's like, look, you know, this happened at one church and now we've got this reporting hotline and everything's great. And I'm like, see, this is what happens when we don't ask enough questions, because if you're just taking what they tell you at face value, then yes, it does seem like it's an isolated instance. And, you know, they've rolled out a reporting hotline now, which they didn't really have before. But then you look into both of those things and you realize that, A, it's not an isolated incident at all. In fact, there are multiple churches with varying degrees of abuse and assault and misconduct that span the spectrum that did not make the news and did not get put out there in the public eye. And, you know, maybe they will at some point, maybe they won't. But, you know, as I alluded to in the first episode, you know, my ex-wife was a victim and will likely never see justice. But her story took place here in Columbus, Ohio. So it had nothing to do with Duluth and Anaheim and the things that happened there. So to assume that it was, that it is something that occurred only at a small Vineyard church somewhere, that were off kind of doing their own thing and going rogue is I think, you know, ignoring the greater, the whole picture here and is sort of kind of covering your eyes to what's really going on. And then also, again, the whole point of the podcast was to look at the system itself and how did these things occur? How were they allowed to occur? And how were they allowed to go on for so long? Because we're talking about a situation, especially in Duluth, where a lot of these horrible, horrific things that happened to these poor young women happened decades ago. And it's just now coming to light. And so how were these things allowed to persist for so long? Well, we have to look at the system. And that's the core theme of the podcast, right, is looking at power and the power structure, who has the power, who doesn't, and so on and so forth. So, and then it also assume that it only happens at small churches is not true either. Duluth was a rather large vineyard, and some of the local allegations that I'm aware of here in Columbus, one of them was at the Columbus Vineyard, which is one of the biggest ones, if not the biggest one in the country now, and is definitely considered the flagship church now. So it can and has happened everywhere. And, you know, so my concern, I think, you know, and a lot of the victims' concerns are that have they made enough changes to at least limit the amount of damage something like that could inflict in the future? I think it's naive to think that there's anything or any system that you can put into place that's going to be perfect and prevent any of these things from ever happening again. That's just not the reality of the world we live in. But do you have appropriate training? Do you have appropriate reporting mechanisms? Do you have a system in place that can minimize the damage and then get help to the victims immediately? So that's the question. So I had some folks reach out who became pretty clear, I think, in their emails that, you know, this was not a fun listen for them, which I understand. And I think they felt like, you know, that it was sort of attacking the vineyard. So let me just read this out and I will respond as best I can. So one listener reached out with some concerns. He said, "I believe in balanced reporting. And since people are complex and each of us is far more than our failures, you didn't present one positive thing about the Gatlins as if God had no role in their lives or the life of the Duluth Vineyard." And then he asks, "Brother, are you a brother? Can you expose the truth without resorting to sensationalism and smear tactics? Tell the whole truth, not just part of it." So a lot to unpack there. Number one, as it pertains to balanced reporting. I think the individual who emailed me may misunderstand how balanced journalism is defined. So if you look at the actual definition of balanced journalism, it is not defined as balanced in the sense of providing one positive thing for every negative thing. That's not balanced journalism. Balanced journalism reflects the complexity of an issue, holds powerful voices accountable, and does not mistake neutrality for truth. And so, yeah, so maybe, you know, I didn't talk about some of the positive things that the Gatlin did, and I'm not naive to think that, you know, they're all bad. I don't think that's true at all, nor do I think that any of the individuals named in the podcast are all bad or all good or, you know, and I would wholeheartedly agree that, you know, life is complex that no one person is defined by one thing that they've done. So, so I would wholeheartedly agree with that. But the topic and the theme of the podcast was to look at what things happened and look at why they happened. And so, you know, so again, you know, trying to hold, as I said, powerful voices accountable. And so, so that's point number one, I would say. Point number two is at no point did I say through the duration of the series that God wasn't at work with either the Gatlins or at Duluth. Human beings, like I said, are very complex and certainly not defined by one thing. Again, however, the focus of the series was about the abuse that occurred. And so we had to talk about that. The stuff that was not reported and the system and structure that protected it and allowed it to occur. The third point I would make is the definition of sensationalism is the use of exaggerated, emotionally charged or misleading content to provoke strong reactions like fear, outrage and shock and attract attention, often at the expense or of accuracy or nuance. An example of this would be like reporting on a church abuse investigation by highlighting the lurid personal details without explaining the systemic accountability failure. The definition of smear tactics is the use of deliberate attacks on a person's character to discredit them, especially when not supported by relevant evidence or tied to the public interest. It often involves innuendo, guilt by association, or misleading framing. As an example of that, this might be instead of investigating how a megachurch mishandled abuse claims, a piece fixates on the pastor's divorce as a sign of moral failure without showing relevance. So again, a couple things I would note in response to that. Throughout the series, I only reported on things where there was clear evidence or clear corroboration. So a lot of things you've probably noticed that I've mentioned, I've pulled from the various internal investigations that were done, police reports, internal communications where there's an email chain, paper trail that has either been posted on Duluth's website and or shared with me by the parties involved that have, a clear chain of communication there. And so, and again, anything that I was told by individuals who were who came forward, I would not report on unless it was corroborated by additional individuals. And so wanted to make sure that I was sticking to the facts. In addition to that, I also made a decision early on to release the full interviews for a couple of reasons. Number one, this was the first time a lot of them were able to share their stories with a larger audience. And I felt it was important for their entire stories to be heard. Again, I think, a lot of these folks telling them for the first time, it was clearly very painful, but very important. And I also didn't want people to think that I was crafting a narration that maybe wasn't fully true. And I was pulling sound bites maybe out of interviews. And so wanted to make sure that people knew that that I was being truthful to the stories being told to me, and also allowing people to speak for themselves and tell their own story. And so so that would be my response to that piece. What else here? Let me see what the other question is. Let's see. Let me make sure I got all these. So there's another one. There's another really good question that I want to make sure I address here. One of them was, I had a couple people reach out about the LGBTQ affirming episode. And so I do want to address that one as well. I want to preface that one also by stating that I also try to make it very clear. In fact, I say this explicitly at the beginning of that episode that that episode is not intended for us to get into a debate about where we personally stand on the issue from a theological perspective. I think it's disingenuous also to say, one individual emailed me and said that, I should have stated my position on that right out of the gate. And I would say, no, I shouldn't have and would not have, and it would not be appropriate because, again, it's not about whether or not you're affirming. It is about power, and it is about how individuals who simply wanted to have a conversation on the subject were treated by the Vineyard, when a lot of these folks in the early days, at least, there was no official policy at the time. You know, you can maybe make the argument later on that, okay, they should have known where the Vineyard stands, but the Vineyard has never really come out expressly and said, you know, we are anti-affirming. They've never really said that. And the stories that I've have been recounted to me, even in regards to Jay's conversations about his own church in Mile High, reflect that, where, you know, they've kind of gone back and forth on this. Now, behind the scenes, you know, it's been made very clear to me that has been something that, you know, they are prepared to take a stand on. But again, it kind of contradicts sort of the Vineyard's sort of what they're known for. So if you go back to the early days of Vineyard being a big tent, you know, calling themselves a big tent organization, meaning that there's room for everyone, and saying, you know, there's room for everybody to, you know, to kind of differ on certain things. That kind of flies in the face of that. And also, if you look at historical context on how they've handled similar issues, women in leadership, for example, you know, obviously, anytime that you make a change within your organization, it's never going to be clean. It's always going to be a little messy, right? There are always people that are going to disagree, no matter what you do, whichever stance you take. You're gonna make somebody mad, right? But the ways in which that they handled that, and I believe that was under Bert Wagoner's tenure, seemed to be a little bit more gentle than the ways in which they've handled the LGBTQ issue. And so what I was pointing out is, like, there's not even, if there's not even room for conversation or dialogue about something like that, you have to kind of ask yourself, you know, well, what kind of organization are we? Well, we can't even, you know, the actual congregations within the movement don't get a voice and don't even get to have a conversation about it. It's just a straight no, no reason given. It's just a no, and or just you're pushed out. And so that was the whole point I was trying to make. And so I don't, you know, I was not about to proclaim my particular theological view on it, you know, because quite frankly, it's not my business to tell you how you should land on the issue. And quite frankly, I don't really care what your stance is either. So not to be mean, just to say that that's, again, to go back to what I just said, that it was not meant to be a debate on the theological position on that topic in general. So that's for another podcast, for another time. We can all have our, you know, theological disagreement on that. And there's also, I would also note, one of the individuals who emailed me inferred that, you know, that only high value scripture people or principled people take the non-affirming position. And I think that's sort of an arrogant position to take, no matter which side you're on. I think there are, and I've spent a lot of time on my other podcasts that I've done for over 10 years talking to a lot of biblical scholars and people on both sides, and there are equally strong arguments on both sides that both do a lot of rigorous scriptural research and have good supported arguments for both. But for some reason, that particular topic it's become this sort of shouting match. And so, but regardless, it comes down to how we treat people and, you know, and ultimately, can we have a friendly civil discussion on a topic? Now, if that topic and other topics, and I would say we can kind of parlay this into the reorg, I firmly believe, I'm firmly a believer in, you know, the church body, meaning the local church, is having a voice and having a vote. And ultimately, I think they're the ones that should help dictate the future of the movement, not a small group of people in high positions of power. And so I think some of the pastors that kind of got pushed out or deemed as problematic were people who were simply asking for an opportunity to be part of the conversation. And so, you know, if the majority of the vineyard does not want to be affirming, or if the majority of the vineyard wants to have a particular theological stance and make that part of the formal official belief of the vineyard, then okay, then there's a process for doing that. And so, all right, let us move on. In relation to that, somebody did ask if the vineyard was ever connected with any sort of conversion therapy, or they also call it reparative therapy, where it's basically pseudoscience, I think is fair to say. It's they use sort of psychological techniques to try to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. I will take a hard stance on this based on the fact that it has been widely discredited by every major psychological association. Studies on it have shown that it causes deep psychological harm, increased depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation. People who have been through it, the studies show, are more than twice as likely to attempt suicide, according to a landmark 2020 study. And so, you know, it's been rejected by the medical community. It's condemned by every major medical and mental health organization, including the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the National Association of Social Workers, the World Health Organization. These organizations classify the practice as unethical, unscientific, and harmful. Actually, there are 28 U.S. states and over 100 municipalities that have banned conversion therapy for minors, citing human rights violations. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it's not effective. There's no credible study ever done that has shown that it works. And so when someone asked about that, there was some association with an individual who was affiliated with the Vineyard at one time, who had a ministry called Desert something or other and Living Waters. He is, to my knowledge, no longer affiliated or associated with the Vineyard. They did send folks to that ministry at some point. I know Jay's church did in Denver, but to my knowledge, that is not a current practice anymore. So, all right. Another really great question. Someone asked me to do an analysis on Jay's letter. So Jay published a letter in March. And so I do want to kind of look at some of those things. And so the letter in general, I think, you know, it's up on the website. Anybody can read it. There's some concerns and some good things in there. So let me start out by saying, out of the good things, you know, there was some apologies made. But I think the problem is sort of in the way that it's worded, the way that it's phrased. And so let's take a look at that a little bit. So, we'll call it language of regret versus institutional accountability. So the positive, again, is that the letter includes multiple apologies and acknowledges specific failures in past processes, which is, you know, can be very rare at times in evangelical leadership culture. The issue, though, is that the way the apology is framed, it's framed in the passive voice, which means the example that would be like, for example, where he says our processes were woefully inadequate. And the part where he says, Phil Stroud and others acted within the structures that existed. The wording of this deflects direct accountability from specific leaders or decision makers who allowed failures to persist, particularly in the Gatling case. So that's what I mean by passive voice. So it kind of, again, deflects accountability there. Like, well, there's nothing we can do. It's the structure that was in place at the time when, in fact, we know that there were things that they could have done. There's also the issue of omission. There's no mention of disciplinary action, removal, or restitution for the leaders, i.e. Michael and Brenda Gatlin, who presided over the abusive culture, or Vineyard USA officials who dismissed early warnings. Again, we can look back to the Ryan Bowers letter, Rich Nathan's opposition to using Grace for the investigation, even though they claim that he was not acting in an official capacity. They did say, and it is in print in writing in an email, that, hey, you should talk to Rich about his experience with Grace. You know, there's intent behind that, I have no doubt.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
The implication here, though, is without direct naming of consequences for those who caused harm or enabled abuse, the apology runs the risk of re-traumatizing survivors and appearing performative. And again, re-traumatizing language towards survivors. The letter calls for reconciliation and forgiveness and discourages survivors from indiscriminately broadcasting our grievances, even if they are justified. This is dangerously close to spiritual bypassing. It urges survivors towards silence, peacemaking, or grace without institutional justice being fully realized. And I think that was largely one of the largest complaints from the victims in regards to both the apology letter, the video that they released, and the actions they've taken since. It also frames public accountability as a threat to unity, implying that survivors who speak out may be harming the body of Christ, which mirrors language often used to discredit whistleblowers. The implication here is that this may discourage survivors from coming forward, reinforces shame, and centers the institution's image over victim healing. And this is one of the concerning things that I pointed out numerous times. There are a bunch of different instances of this where, you know, whether you go back to Jay's talk at the event in I believe it was Florida back in March as well, where he makes it very clear that he does not want people talking publicly about their grievances within the church. He wants to keep it very in-house, you know. So it's, again, it really looks like, and again, hard to understand intent there, but very much looks like damage control, keep it in-house, keep it hush-hush, try to quell the dissent internally. Very concerning. Misleading or incomplete narrative about Duluth. The letter refers to 2014 allegations against Michael and Brenda Gatlin, stating the Duluth board found them unsubstantiated, yet does not name the internal conflict of interest, given that Brenda Gatlin held power over staff and reports. And again, I think it's disingenuous to lean on the fact that nothing was found in that investigation, because again, if you look at the Grace report, they point out, and rightfully so, that they did sort of internally investigate. They had somebody come in and sort of ask, hey, are any of you experiencing abuse at the hands of the Gatlins? Well, the Gatlins are still in power. No one is going to speak up. You know, they're in a position where, you know, there could be retaliation, because again, still to this day, there are no anti-retaliation policies in place. So, you know, again, very concerning there. The letter also implies that Vineyard USA acted appropriately under prior systems. But again, if you look at everything that we talked about over the course of the 8 chapters, concerns were repeatedly raised to national leadership. The national office refused to escalate to Grace. Rob Morgan, again, repeatedly recommended that Michael Gatlin lead the church through a crisis he helped create. And again, the implication here is that this framing softens or distorts the extent of systemic inaction, placing the burden on old structures rather than leadership failure. Because again, multiple instances where the national office is made aware. And another one is the HLI report, the 56-page report that one of the former students of HLI sent to the Vineyard National Office that was then forwarded right back to Michael Gatlin and buried for years until the Grace investigation uncovered it in his inbox. So, you know, it very much kind of, again, deflects or creatively words things in a way that doesn't point the blame on them. Promised reforms lack key details. And this is pretty consistent here. So again, even if you look at the new bylaws and the new employee handbook, they always lack key details that I think are important for these changes to actually have any sort of teeth to them or any positive effect. So Jay outlines four reform areas, but each lacks implementation specifics, deadlines, or enforcement mechanisms. So the four things he points out are clear ordination framework, which, again, as we talked about in the last couple episodes, there's no real clarity at all in terms of, you know, who's the arbiter of if any individual who is applying for ordination has met the criteria in terms of theological and biblical knowledge or is living a biblical life. You know, and all these different things are just super, super vague. There's no clarity in terms of who ultimately decides that they've met that level. It's just incredibly vague. And so I think there's a lot of issues with the ordination framework as it stands today. Second one is external reporting mechanisms. Beyond the fact that, as we noted, and Jay himself says on Vineyard's podcast, at the end of the day, yes, the reporting line is there. It does go to Guidepost, but Guidepost ultimately forwards that information back to Vineyard USA. So if you are reporting on someone who is at the national level, that's problematic. But oftentimes, the national team will forward it back to the local church, often about the people that are being reported on there as well. So that is problematic, not to mention the fact that no mention of who runs this reporting hotline, whether these reports are ever made public or how decisions are enforced. And then there's the third one, trauma-informed care referrals. There's no detail in provider vetting, accessibility or survivor involvement in choosing counselors. And then the last one, improved training. There's no proof that training is mandatory, that it's ongoing, or that it's evaluated for effectiveness. And I think that's a big one right now, because it's become very clear throughout the course of researching for this podcast that, you know, a lot of individuals at both the local and national levels just really caught off guard when these scandals hit, and clearly were not trained and did not know the proper course of action to take. And so in this day and age, that's just unacceptable. You have got to invest the time and effort and the money into ensuring that the proper training occurs on a regular enough basis, so it's fresh and it's updated. Everyone should go through it, should not be, you know, elective. It should be mandatory. And there should also be some evaluation process to make sure that it is, in fact, effective. So the implication here is that these bullet points appear more like optics-focused reforms than substantive structural change. And then ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, with sort of this push for the reorg changes, there's a failure to address structural power concerns. So nowhere in that letter or anywhere else does Jay, as national director, recognize or address Vineyard USA's centralized power in the national team, or the lack of term limits or external board oversight, or how future abuse of power will be prevented at the national level. Because as I mentioned in, I believe, the last episode, you know, if you're going to push through a reorg like this, and there are parts of the reorg in terms of issues or opportunities identified that I think most people within the Vineyard, and I say that because several of them told me so, that they agree that these changes probably needed to be made. Maybe not in the entire list, but like certainly some of the list. And so, you know, local churches may have to give up some amount of autonomy to ensure that there's the checks and balances in place at the local level, and that a local pastor like the Gatlin's, a situation like that doesn't happen again. And that, you know, the local church and the national group have the ability to serve as a check on that. But in order for a local church to feel comfortable doing that, at least in my personal opinion, is that there needs to be the same level of accountability baked in at the national level. And so right now, a national director and many of the national positions have no term limits. And quite frankly, the local churches, and this would concern me if I was a local church, have no say in who gets elected or appointed to those positions, because it's not really an election, right? It's an appointment. So, you know, it and this last one seemed to be done sort of kind of behind closed doors, right? Everybody just kind of was like, oh, I'm not surprised Jay got it, but, you know, there was no formal election there or list of candidates in which to vote for. And, you know, so I think if I was in that position, I would want that to change. I would also want to make sure that there's an annual review process and that there is a way to hold the national director and the associate national directors accountable. So whether that's a vote of no confidence or, you know, a formal channel or way to, levy accusations, you know, but again, the fundamental structure and the ways in which those people attain positions has to change, right? So like you can't have a board of trustees that was appointed primarily by the national director and are close and dear friends of that person. You can't expect them to hold that person accountable. It's just never going to happen. And largely that's why Duluth and Anaheim were allowed to happen because of the close relationships between the parties involved. So there's got to be some change there. And again, just in general, these issues were at the heart of the scandals in Duluth, Anaheim, and others yet go unmentioned. So, the reform appears localized to pastoral misconduct, not systemic organizational failure. So on, you know, they talk a lot about like, well, we need to be able to hold pastors, accountable. And Jay talks about like this shrug, you know, like, what can we do? Well, you know, it's not just exclusive to the local level. It's clear that the national level also failed massively in these scenarios, and there should be, you know, accountability at that level as well. And again, just to kind of reiterate, discrediting public transparency, Jay's language about online conflict and indiscriminate broadcasting of grievances comes across as a veiled critique of whistleblowers, journalists, or survivors who go public, an effort to re-centralize power over the narrative, and given Vineyard USA's documented culture of secrecy, this tone is inappropriate and sends a chilling message to those seeking accountability. There's also a conflation of institutional pain with survivor pain. The letter closes with, "We're sorry, we see you, please forgive us," but does not outline a process for restitution. It does not invite victims into policy reform or survivor-led input, offer direct compensation, public truth-telling, or reconciliation initiatives. The implication here is that it centers institutional grief rather than survivor healing and appears to seek closure without fully earning it. Positive elements worth noting: acknowledgement of structural failures, public apology for the Duluth mishandling, albeit partial, commitment to trauma-informed practices, if fully implemented, that's the caveat there, intent to build systems, not just rely on relationships. So again, to kind of tie a bow on this. Conclusion, is this substantive change? No, at least not yet. While the tone is more conciliatory than past communications, the letter avoids naming or disciplining enablers of harm, discourages survivor-led transparency, lacks specifics on enforcement or independent oversight, reframes systemic inaction as outdated policy, no leadership failure, subtly recenters institutional image over victims' needs. And as it stands, this letter is a well-crafted PR move with limited structural substance. Survivors and advocates should remain cautious and press for detailed timelines, independent oversight, term limits, and survivor involvement in reforms. So, you know, again, this kind of comes back to another question, and this will flow nicely into the next question. Have they done enough? Because there is a narrative right now that, hey, Vineyard USA has done enough. We're ready to move on and get back to life as normal. And I would say absolutely not. They have not done enough yet. They have the opportunity to do more and get it right, I think. And I'm hoping that's what happens. But they've done a lot of talking about what they're going to do, but not a lot of actual action. And some of the good things that they've done, they've implemented trauma-informed training, although it's, again, unclear whether or not this is mandatory. They have implemented a solid child protection policy and publicly admitted that the system in place is ill-equipped to deal with these types of situations. However, as we just noted, the reporting hotline is not truly a third-party reporting line. There's no transparency in terms of who handles the reports, if any of the data is reported publicly, or what actions are taken as a result of what's reported. There still isn't a true nepotism policy, which isn't entirely surprising because, again, as I noted in the series, the national director's wife is an associate national director. So, you know, I think it would be hard to enforce a true nepotism policy until the national arm models the behavior they wish to see. Unfortunately, you know, if I had to put my money on it, I don't foresee them implementing any meaningful nepotism or conflict of interest policies that extend beyond financial conflicts of interest until, you know, anytime soon. But I just don't see that happening. There are also still no whistleblower protections in place, and they continue to try to suppress any dissent within the movement. That should be very concerning. And again, the ordination criteria are insanely vague and open to vast interpretation, which makes it appear as if they were more concerned about getting a policy in place to control the ordination itself and be able to thus control the pastor, versus any sort of meaningful criteria to ensure they're elevating the right types of people. And as we talked about in the episode where I interviewed a local Lutheran pastor here, just as an example, there's a lot of really beneficial things that could and should probably be in place in terms of ordination. Beyond just saying, hey, this person is gifted and meant to be in leadership. Well, that's great. Like, let's equip them in such a way, you know, as JT Meyer alluded to in his interview, let's equip them so they're not set up to fail. And I would say that in any job, honestly. Through the reorg, they've now managed to push through sign-off by the local churches. Last I heard, it was estimated to be around 90% of the churches, where, you know, by signing off on it, again, you've ceded power to the national arm with no checks and balances in place at that national level. So basically, that gives the national arm the ability to come in and remove your pastor and replace them with whoever they want, which also, by the way, gives them complete control over the church and its assets. So, that should be concerning to most people. So those are a few thoughts. I will put that analysis up online too, in case you all fell asleep while I was reading through that, which totally understand. So again, let's talk about, I'll answer a few quick questions here because I realize it's getting long here on this one. And then we'll talk about real quick, like what needs to happen, or an idea of what could happen, that would probably help. Let's see here. Let's do a negative one, shall we? All right. Let's see. Oh, maybe I read them all. One of the things I found was interesting, I just want to comment on this, is had a couple individuals sort of infer the same thing when they emailed me. One asked me if I really was a brother. One asked me what my connection was to Vineyard. First of all, I stated that up front in the first episode, which sort of leads me to believe, and I'm sort of used to this. I've done podcasting, like I said, for 10 years. And yeah, you get some critics, like you're not going to make everybody happy. And I get that and have long since learned that lesson. But it becomes very clear very quickly who has actually listened and who has just made assumptions and has cast accusations. And you know, you expect a little bit of that. So for the individual, if they are listening, I would address that by saying we're all brothers and sisters in Christ, first of all. So I don't know what you meant specifically by brother, but we all are all children of God, I would say. Second of all, my affiliation with the Vineyard, I stayed up front, but should be irrelevant from my ability to research facts and articulate, you know, what I believe the results of those facts are. My ability to look objectively at the bigger picture, you know, should have no bearing on my personal theological convictions. And so I would say the two are not connected. But again, if you are curious about my personal affiliation with the Vineyard, I do mention that in the first episode. So there's that. All right. Somebody asked if there's going to be a second season. It's sort of up in the air. I kind of go back and forth day by day. This one, first season took a lot out of me. And so I definitely need a break. I think a big part of it, and this comes from a place where I feel, incredibly honored to have people trust me with their stories and to share those with me. And a lot of those folks, like I said, it was the first time that they had shared these things openly or publicly. And there were some conversations I had with people off the record, who shared, details of their personal stories that did not make it into the podcast because they just were not ready to go public yet, but just wanted to share it with me. And I greatly am humbled and appreciate that. And, so that weighs heavily, you know, and, you know, there are some tears and, definitely, some tough moments where it definitely starts to wear on you after a while. You know, I get emails every single day, which I appreciated. And again, just thoroughly honored, to have been a part of. And so this does feel like the most important work that I've ever done. And I feel, obligated and beholden to the people who trusted me with their stories to continue to try to push for some level of justice, whatever that looks like, whether it's just shining a light on it long enough for some changes to occur. At this point, you know, whether it's this podcast or, you know, media somewhere picking it up and writing a story about it, that gets national attention. I think that's the important part. And that's the thing that's ultimately going to result in any kind of meaningful change. Cause I think, you know, from everything that I have been told, it sort of sounds like Vineyard USA is trying very hard to kind of hush it up internally, and try to hope that it blows over. They are also though to their, you know, I will give them some, slack here because, they are engaged in not one, but now two, lawsuits. And so, to some degree they can't respond. But to answer that question, no, they have not. I did reach out to both Vineyard USA, a couple times and, Anaheim, both initially responded, but as you guys know, Anaheim is, or dwelling place, I should say now, is in a lawsuit. With some of the former members of Anaheim, and so they can't really talk about it. Perhaps at some point when that lawsuit is over, they might be willing to share their side. I think would be worth hearing. And then Vineyard USA, you know, just said, "Hey, listen, you know, we want to kind of handle this in-house," and you know, okay. So, but I did. After the podcast came out, give them another opportunity to sort of answer some of the questions that are out there. Cause I think it's, people deserve to hear an answer and, the offer is still on the table. But again, they're engaged in not one, but two lawsuits. They've got currently, my understanding is 10 of the victims from Duluth, are currently, you know, each, you know, have filed suits against Jackson, Michael and Brenda, Duluth Vineyard, and Vineyard USA. And so they're in the discovery phase right now. So we'll wait to see how that one plays out. And then there was another lawsuit filed just this past week by a victim alleging abuse at the hands of a youth pastor at the Anaheim location as well. So we'll see how that one plays out as well. Couple other questions I just want to say or answer before we wrap up. You know, one person asked, let's see here. I just want to make sure that I don't miss anything, before we get to the very, very end here. There was a narrative going around. Somebody asked about, there's a narrative that is going around, Mile High in Denver about, basically like the lawsuit. So I did want to address that. So for anybody that's heard this narrative, I can confidently, dispel any false, false narratives floating around. So the first part of it was that Jackson was charged with statutory rape because the one victim who's a minor lied about her age. And as soon as he found out her true age, he broke things off with her. That is unequivocally false. All you need to do is read the criminal complaint and read the internal investigation done. There are a number of witnesses and a number of staff who participated in those. There were a number of underage girls who he engaged in some sort of relationship with. There are some pretty gruesome details in the criminal complaint. So I think for anybody who's walking around who thinks that that is the case, that is absolutely false and easy to disprove just by reading the court documents and or the investigation. So that is false. The second part, you know, is he has allegedly, they said that he has admitted to, you know, all of his wrongdoing, which I think is also we can say is false. And the reason I say that is because in the criminal trial for which he was convicted for a sentence of 13 years in prison, he only pled guilty to one of the five, and took an Alford plea on the other four. And an Alford plea essentially is you're not admitting guilt there, but what you're saying is there is a preponderance of evidence and more than enough to convict you. And so it's sort of you get a lesser sentence typically when taking an Alford plea. So that by nature, I would say, suggests that he has not admitted all of his guilt in these situations. Also allegedly allegedly said that he does not know who all these new women are who have come forward with allegations. And I think as this court case plays out, I think you will see that is absolutely false as well. So more to come on that. I would say pay attention to the court proceedings. You will learn a lot there. Additionally, Vineyard USA is sort of deflecting all blame in that court case, which is part of with the discovery phase and bringing forth evidence. There is indications that to some extent, that there was some knowledge going back as far as like 2007. The other piece of it, too, is that, you know, the other narrative running around is that Vineyard, you know, wants the right people to be held accountable and that they're just scapegoating Michael and Brenda, which is absolutely ludicrous. When you look at the number of times that Michael and Brenda, you know, had complaints against them or feedback via the 360 feedback report. But also additionally, you know, if you look in the court records and in the Grace report, there are two instances documented where mothers of victims actually went directly to Brenda and said, in no uncertain terms, your son is sexually abusing my daughter. And Brenda said something to the extent of your daughter just wants attention, and then hung up the phone. And so for them to say that Michael and Brenda aren't at least to some extent accountable, based on all the information that's come out is absurd. And then there's something about like, they're just doing it for the insurance money. Well, to my knowledge, and I could be wrong, so if somebody knows more about this than I do, I don't believe a dollar amount was even, in the conversation, and I don't know that they even have named a dollar amount yet, although there are some rumors now about dollar amounts. So I think you've got a lot of frustrated victims out there who had to live with this for a long, long time. And sometimes if you can't get justice through the criminal system, then civil is the only way that you can do it. And so I think once these civil trials are done, because right now the victims can't really publicly speak. And so I think once the civil trial is over, I would imagine that you will see at least some of them go speak a little bit more publicly and we'll learn a lot more. So, you know, we'll wait and see. But yeah, that's just silly to say that it's just about money, or that Michael and Brenda were not accountable to this, because I think there's absolutely evidence to suggest that they were. So, all right, let's finish this up. So I think I answered all the questions. If you guys have additional questions that I have not addressed, please let me know. You can email me at spoiledfruitpodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM me through any of the social media. And again, I've had some very interesting, I will say, interactions with individuals on social media lately. Most of them very, very good and positive. Some a little, I will say, strange. I would just say, like, hey, if you've got a question or a concern, especially if you have a concern, please reach out. I'm very easy to get a hold of through either of those two means. I've responded, or at least tried to respond, to everyone who has reached out, good, bad, and the ugly. And, you know, like, you know, we're adults. And so if you have a question, don't assume something, reach out. And I'm more than happy to talk through things or whatever. So if you have questions, or if you've heard something and you want to get clarification, just let me know. More than happy to clarify. So real quick, and we kind of did this in the last episode, but I want to give you guys, you know, the most up-to-date I can. So I don't, as far as I can see, I have not seen any fundamental changes to any of the policies or the handbook since the last episode, which is not that long ago. And so this goes back again to, have they done enough? And again, my answer to that would be not yet. And so, you know, I think at first, you know, you got to separate the two. There's the changes that need to occur at the local level, and there's the changes that need to happen at the national level. And then you've got sort of the intermediaries, like the regional folks and the super regional and the area leaders, you know, who sort of serve as that go-between. So I think there definitely could be some more restructuring of that structure, but then you can also repurpose those positions and just tweak the job descriptions a little bit. So I think largely the structure and the positions already exist to be successful. I think personally, when I'm modeling it against, and I did run an analysis against five other older denominations who have been kind of doing this thing for a while, I think I think it could be done. I really do. I think it would require a lot of humility, I think, and some work. Some things could be implemented overnight, and other things would probably take a while. But I think you start at the local level, which to some degree they've already done. So through formal ordination, there's a way to hold local pastors accountable. What doesn't exist, though, there's a way to remove that person entirely, right? But I think what also needs to be implemented along with that, if you're being sincere about trying to make sure that, you know, there's not a power issue or, you know, local pastor isn't being completely inappropriate. I think there also needs to be a some sort of mechanism in place for that pastor to appeal, to perhaps have some sort of trial. They feel if they disagree. But there also should be consistency within every local church. I think where we've seen some things become problematic is that not every church does certain things the same way. And I think you can still have a lot of autonomy, but when it comes to the rules, I think the local level, there needs to be consistency in terms of every single church should have some sort of church council, whether you call it a church council or a board of elders or a church board, whatever you want to call it, should have roughly the same number of people on it. And there should be a process by which the church itself can vote on those members as opposed to them being appointed by the local pastor, because I think you have to build in that accountability, right? So like when we talk about conflicts of interest and nepotism, like, you know, there should be policies in place for that as well. I think one of the things that they could take away from some of the other older denominations is they also should have bylaws at each church that at least include certain basics, and that everyone should, you know, it should be mandatory for all Vineyard churches to have certain things in their bylaws, just protections for them and for the people that attend there. I think that would be very important as well, since those kind of vary wildly. I think there does need to be a nepotism policy. I think that needs to be instituted. I also think that there should be some sort of succession plan. I think that is true. I think that is a real concern that a lot of pastors built these churches from the ground up with their blood, sweat, and tears, and sort of they're aging out now. And there is no formal process by which, you know, you can, place a new pastor in that position. And so it's done differently at every location. There's one here north of me who did it very successfully. The pastor was set to retire. There was another pastor on staff, and it was a very smooth transition from my understanding, and done very well. So there are processes for that in other churches that have been around a long time. And so defining such a process would be, I think, helpful, and getting input from the congregation itself and assistance from your regional and area leaders, I think, would be helpful. Let's see, what else? National. So then again, you know, at the national level, I think there's a lot of potentially problematic, things baked into the national arm. So again, there's a clear structure now. So you got national director, associate national directors, you've got the board of trustees, and then you've got the executive team of three, and then you've got some other national positions. You've got your super regional leaders. However, there isn't a clear process in terms of obtaining one of these positions beyond seemingly knowing the right people and getting appointed. There's no election process by the church body, so it's very insular in terms of who gets a position and who doesn't, and not very transparent at all. And again, no term limits, no term lengths for the most part. Very little in the way of accountability. So really only the board of trustees can hold the national director accountable, and they're generally handpicked by the national director. You're not gonna out your friend, right? So I think there's some issues there. I think the board of trustees should be independent of the national director. I think there should be annual reviews. Whether it's a vote of no confidence or some sort of disciplinary mechanism baked in. Again, I sort of joked about this on the website where I wrote a job description for an HR consultant, where I wrote a note off to the side that said, it's a lot cheaper to pay an HR consultant than court fees. But I'm kind of serious. Like a lot of things could be solved for by having a dedicated HR person or team. They can help ensure that any level is compliant. They can ensure that there are no conflicts of interest. They can handle HR related questions. They can advise, they can help with disciplinary actions. They can field the reporting hotline and ensure that action is taken, that it goes to the right people, that there's confidentiality, et cetera, et cetera. And then the middle, the sort of middle positions there, you know, like I said, the regional leaders, the area leaders. If you go back and read the ordination survey that we discussed, it's pretty clear in the responses that a lot of the folks in those positions feel like they don't have a lot of the power support that they need to support the local pastors and churches, and or don't feel like their voice or questions and concerns really go anywhere. And so, you know, there are some things that you can do to fix that. And again, just in general, it does not appear that the local churches really have much of a say in the direction of the movement. And so, the reorg was sort of pushed through, as we talked about, very quickly, with very little input, or at least feigned input, we'll say. I think the reorganization survey was very problematic when we broke it down. And there could be some better work done there. So again, to end this, if Vineyard USA are really actually serious about fundamental change that would at least help minimize future damage, they do a couple of things, and some of these suggestions could be implemented fairly quickly. Some would take a little bit longer, but you know, I think there's some clear directions that they could go. And again, they've got the child protection policy in place, which is excellent. They still need whistleblower protections. They still need a true nepotism policy, a true third-party reporting hotline, and consistency across the organization. I still think there's a debate to be had over whether homogeneity is necessary for the Vineyard of the future to thrive. even though that seems to be the direction that they're headed, you know, just in terms of certain things theologically, if that's the way you want to go, then you know, there's a way to do that. But I do think that it only makes sense to have the people who are sitting in your pews help decide the future of the movement and have a voice in it. And again, you can look at other established denominations who have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years who have those mechanisms in place, and they work. There is no perfect system, but there are systems that work a little bit better than having no system. And so I think there are some examples that they could pull from out there if they were truly serious about it. So with that all having been said, I thank you guys again so much for listening to the podcast. We'll see about season two. I'm still trying to figure out how that will play out, how that will look. I don't simply want to rehash, similar stories over and over again. Some folks have asked, will I cover some of the allegations here in my neck of the woods in Columbus? I will say I've addressed this numerous times now, and so I'll address it here. It's very, very difficult depending on the circumstance. And so even in the situation of my own ex-wife's story, because it happened so long ago, because it was so fundamentally mismanaged at the time it occurred, they didn't consult law enforcement. So there's no police report. They did not take her to the hospital to perform a rape kit. And so there's no evidence. And then you've got the problem of so many years that have gone by since then. And so it really becomes one person's word versus the other. And it just makes it that much more difficult. And so that's the reason why I made the decision to go with the two largest, most public scandals, because there is a dearth of evidence out there, both publicly and obviously law enforcement was engaged. There's police reports, there's news articles about these. So it was very, very easy for me to pull from and to research and that sort of thing. And also I am not a part of a major network. And so I also have to do my best to maintain journalistic integrity and to also make sure that I'm not, putting out there just, things that are not true and or reporting on things I just simply don't have enough information or research on. So so it all depends. I'm not saying it's impossible, but, there would have to be some additional, I think, things that would have to occur for me to be able to cover those. And also, at the end of the day, it still points back to the main thread of the podcast, which is, power, empire building, who has the power, how have they used the power, how have they maybe abused the power. And so all of these stories collectively all sort of point towards the same thing. And so season two, really, I don't want to retell the same story. And so we might look at it more holistically at in evangelical Christianity at large and how these things seem to pop up in other movements. And so I think it's safe to say that most people have probably heard about the things that happened with Hillsong and the things that happened with Mars Hill. And so these things seem to keep happening. And I think if you look closely enough, you see common characteristics and you can see why these things continue to occur. And so we can learn from that. And again, to the person that pointed out that no one's all good and all bad, I absolutely agree. And I believe that the people who, maybe have dragged their feet on making substantive change could still turn this thing around. I want to believe that. And I want to believe that change can happen, meaningful change, and that things could improve. And so here's hoping that will occur. We'll see about season two. Stay tuned. Social media, I will definitely update folks as we go along. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to, folks that are willing to go on record and tell their story. If there's something there, a thread to pull, I will pull it. And I will keep you guys notified all along the way. Other than that, there will be a few, two or three more episodes that I will put out, full interviews rather, that I still have yet to edit, that I will put out as some bonus content. So we're not completely through yet. So look forward to that. Otherwise, I got to take care of my other two podcasts that I've been neglecting for a while. So I'll take a short break and then hopefully we'll be back. So thank you guys so much. Love you and appreciate you listening.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.